This is Living Lab on The Point. I'm Heather Goldstone. The language of scientific studies is often dry, technical, laden with jargon that's foreign even to other scientists from different disciplines. But what lies beneath that, the science itself and the people who pursue it, that is a world of wonder and passion, excitement, frustration, and beauty. And that is the realm of poetry. Poet Len Germanara is among a growing cadre who are fusing science and poetry. He calls his version eco-poetry. Germanara is co-host of Spoken Word Nantucket and resident naturalist and education coordinator at the Nantucket Field Station, where he lives with his wife, Dr. Sarah Okte. She's managing director of the field station and a member of the faculty of UMass Boston. Each year, UMass Boston students come to the field station to learn environmental science and now also eco-poetry. Germanara recently published an anthology of student poetry entitled Veil of Particulates. Len Germanara, Sarah Okte, welcome to Living Lab.
Good morning.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Now, to those of you at home, be sure to get a pencil and paper ready. Len has promised to walk us through one of the exercises he gives his poetry students. Len, poets have been drawing inspiration from nature for centuries. How is what you're doing, how is eco-poetry different from that?
Well, I don't know that it's different. We've tried to incorporate specificity where it's a course of poetics that's offered during a scientific endeavor. We're asking them to specifically name things, and I think that's the important part in poetry is giving the right name to a thing. It's not enough, I don't think, to say gull if you're talking about a specific kind of thing that the animal is doing. So in naming the laughing gull, for example, you know that there are certain things that the laughing gull is going to do and known for, and that gives a little bit more color and a little bit more feeling. I like to tell my my writing students, and I like to tell anybody that what I'm looking for is a full spectrum of feeling, the seeing, the feeling, the smelling, all of the visceral things. If you can incorporate those in your writing, that will be the thing that will help you to convey to the novice, the person that might not have a chance to walk a wild beach and see the profusion of life and to be able to draw some kind of an analogy that will bring them into a place that makes them feel comfortable. And then, oh, I think I could understand the clattering, the chitinous clattering of a million fiddler crabs sounding like my mother whisking eggs in the morning. And it puts you into a place and it gives you a sense of feeling and comfort.
Sarah, as a scientist, do you think that all of those senses and observations are part of the research, are things that are already there, or is there an added level or different kind of mindfulness required to write poetry about science?
Well, where I think it helps for scientists to learn poetry is to learn these observational skills. The things that Len teaches them are to actually observe, and a good scientist really observes the world around them. So it gets them out of their blinder type situation and looking around, listening, hearing. All of that provides information that they might not be open to. So I think it's really a good method for scientists to learn how to be better scientists and to communicate too with the public, so and with themselves, so they get a chance to actually understand what they're looking at and remember it and record it in a way that's much more meaningful.
Len, I wonder if we could give everybody an example. Pick one of the poems from Veil of Particulates. Do you have a particular favorite that you would like to read for us?
Would you like the title poem?
That would be wonderful.
Or the Elizabeth's poem? Or?
Let's go with the title poem. What does Veil of Particulates refer to?
Well, a conversation we were having early on, and I think especially with the environmental students that came down, when you're out on the water here or over specifically on Nantucket where they were, the sunsets and sunrises are really spectacular. The colors are gorgeous. And I remember the first time I remarked about it when I moved to Nantucket with Sarah. I looked up and I marveled at the colors, and she said, yeah, it's beautiful, but it's also pollution. And so that was the conversation. And I predicated the whole conversation that we had in poetics based on the idea that we're looking at the death of nature. And that being a little bit of a gauntlet thrown down, let's talk about nature. And so the Veil of Particulates was something that resonated very early on because it's so beautiful. And when you think about it, it's not really.
Now, I mean, we do sometimes, there's this, I think sometimes tension, this feeling that perhaps understanding the natural world can take some of the beauty out of it. That if you know that the sunset is beautiful because there is pollution in the atmosphere, that somehow lessens it. Is this is writing poetry about it a way to perhaps reverse that or counterbalance that?
I think so. And I work more with younger people and, you know, grade school people. And they care very much about the sound and the feeling that they're conveying. And so those kind of things will serve as a way of saying, no, this is what we need to fight for. We need to fight for a cleaner air and cleaner water. And so we're always going out and poking things and looking around and marveling first at the beauty and then trying to figure out exactly what's going on.
All right. Well, let's hear this poem. It's by student Connor McKay, and it's called Motivation.
And I asked all the students to try to start off as it would be a log entry into a journal. And so that's the way this starts off. It's the 27th of January, 2013, and the poem's by Connor McKay. I saw the moon tonight, low in the sky, hovering above the horizontal water, orange with the veil of particulate suffocating our planet. It was beautiful. It was strange. It provoked me. Why was it so beautiful, in its shallow position in the sky, its street lamp luminosity? What do you want from me? What more can I do? How do I make you, this moment, this experience, significant? I'm glancing between my page and the moon now, high in the Aquarius sky. It shrunk, and its reflected light now penetrates the atmosphere in its familiar, its eerie, its eternal cold white glow. I glance to the street lamp outside my bedside window on Whaler's Lane. The image is a painting in a New England country boutique in an old folks' home. This image is my life now. I no longer despair for existence. The universe is finished, but my status is dynamic. Keep moving. Bring friends.
That is really, an amazingly powerful poem to have come from someone with almost no poetry experience.
I think so. I was very, very pleased with all of the writing. The book, Veil of Particulates, goes the whole spectrum from those that have a love and appreciation of poetry. Connor had and does. Some had never written a poem before, but they all got something from it. And I think that's really what came out of the class for them, was realizing that there's more to pull than the numbers. From an experience when they're out doing scientific surveying or gathering of data, there is that feeling. Some of them are the insufferable cold when you're in the marsh, it's 20 degrees out, or, whatever it is that you have to be doing, if it's a very, very hot day or whatever, those feelings are part of the experience, and they can be lost, but by capturing them, those are the kind of things that fill in the spaces in between the lines of journals. You look at things like Lewis and Clark's journals, and he's doing specific things and gathering up data, but he's also commenting about what happened and maybe somebody stole one of his dogs or something like that and it really set him off. But those are the kind of things that shade in the areas around the edges.
Now, Sarah, how do your students react? They're signing up for a semester in environmental science, environmental studies. How do they react when you tell them that one of the first things they're going to learn is poetry?
It usually throws them off at first. They're like, well, this is not something – they tend to be very practical. So they're like, well, how am I going to use poetry? And why is it important? Why do I need to communicate what I see in such a – awkward form. And one of the first things I tell them is it is a form. It is a way of discipline. And part of being a scientist or learning anything is learning discipline. And I also tell them, I said, you're going to appreciate more what you're enjoying if you're thinking about poetry. And you asked earlier about whether knowing the science and the specifics about a thing made it less beautiful. And to me, it makes it more beautiful. If I look at a blade of grass and think of carbon, hydrogen, and photosynthesis, that makes it more beautiful to me and actually, more poetic. So at first, they're taken aback. They're like, poetry, this is the last thing I think I'd have to do. And a lot of people really have some adverse thoughts about poetry. And once they understand how easy it is, and especially if they see some of our 10 and 11-year-olds doing it, they go, yeah, so this is something that's part of my life. I listen to music every day. Poetry is part of my life, and I can definitely express myself through poetry.
Now, Len, do you have to combat the idea that poetry has to rhyme and have a certain meter and a certain rhythm? Are students, when they first come to poetry, really trying to fit that that form?
Yeah. I always liken the idea, especially with somebody that's never written poetry before, sort of like a kid that will tell you that they don't like Brussels sprouts even though they've never tried them before. And there is sort of an ingrained thing. Oh, you know, they'll hear it from a teacher or they'll hear it from a parent. I don't like it. I have no use for it. And so that's the thing that they, well, yeah, neither do I. And if you have that first conversation with them and you ask them, and you can ask this of anybody, you know, do you have a favorite song? You know, is there kids nowadays, I mean, rap. You know, they've got some kind of a thing going on in their head all the time. You know, we put a soundtrack in our head, and that's what we go to when we're, you know, just sort of thinking about what we're going to do next. We're hearing the music. We're hearing the music all the time.
Now, you teach, as you just alluded to, elementary school students as well as part of your Junior Rangers program.
Right.
How different are the responses and the products that you get? I mean, clearly the vocabulary of a 10-year-old versus a 20-year-old is a different thing.
It's a little bit easier with a kid that's 10 or 11 years old, because what I like to tell all of my students is that I don't have any rules. And if you tell a college-age science student that I don't have any rules, that's the face that Sarah just made is the first one that I get. What do you mean there are no rules? There has to be rules. And I'm not even that much into punctuation or spelling. I don't let that be a block for any of my students. And the writing example that I'm going to give you is sort of based on that kind of an idea, to allow yourself to write without any preconceptions, to not have any roadblocks, to not have any idea that I can't do this or I need to do it this way, because there is no real rule like that.
And you feel that the 10-year-olds or the younger students
they take that much
they revel
easier
in that and just run with it.
One of the students we had last year in the Nantucket semester was continually, almost every class, asking about one rule or convention after the next. And it got to be sort of the whole class would be, Sarah, there are no rules. Lenny doesn't have rules. We don't do those. There's no reason for you not to do something or to ask him if you can, because he's going to tell you, yes, you can. And I think that's the thing, that when you're out on the beach, or, you know, you're out doing what Sarah's always doing, Dr. Oktay's always doing, those kind of things wash over you anyway. You know, you might be very motivated to go out and count horseshoe crabs at the high tide, but you're going to be taken by the spray of silver sides that come up out of the water when you hit them with the lamp. It looks like the 4th of July, you know, and I don't know that many people that can go out and experience something like that, not have that wash over them, you know, not to be just so, I'm just getting the numbers.
Sarah, have you gone through, I guess, a bit of a personal transition, this change from thinking that maybe poetry wasn't something that you did to now clearly embracing it and making it part of your scientific process, essentially?
I have. That's a really great question. I think one of my preconceptions, and a lot of people have the same one, is that, you know, poetry is boring, or it's, you know, something that's not part of our lives. We're used to, in high school, you know, reading a lot of poetry that's not very relevant. And learning from Len and hearing so many spoken word poets that we bring out, seeing slam poetry, which is very performance-based, all of this has helped me understand that poetry can really have, as Len says, you know, no rules, and it can express things in a way that's more open and more clear and has more information than straight science. So I've definitely become a fan of poetry and of appreciating it and liking to read it. I still am a little too literate, or not literate, but literal, when I read over poetry. Len will write something and I go, wait, a firefly doesn't do that. And it'll throw me out of the poem, because I'm like, fireflies are totally, that's completely wrong. So he'll have me science test his poetry. And if I see something that's really not right, then I'll tell him and he'll insert it in such a way that it really is beautiful but correct.
It's one of our first interactions that we had. I had just finished writing a poem based on a UN report, sort of a State of the Union kind of a report about the where we are in the world. And a lot of numbers stated in the report, and I took those as pretty much gospel. I mean, it came from the UN, so it must be right. And Sarah came up to me at one of the first readings that she came to while before we had met and started dating, and she said, you know, your numbers are all wrong. And I said, well, the story only came out last week. And she said, yeah, I know. And that's how we started talking.
So that was your first interaction, was that you couldn't stay with the poem because the numbers weren't quite right.
Yeah, they tease me a lot, actually, a lot of the different writers and poets, because as a scientist, I take things, you know, basically that I can only observe. And so poetry helps get me out of that hole. And sometimes, you know, if I write a poem about a kid going up a hill, I go, well, the kid went up the hill. And Len's like, try to use a metaphor, try to use an analogy. And so it's training me to get away from being too literal.
Do you think that that affects your science in any way, your research, the quality of it?
It certainly doesn't hurt it. It probably makes me more creative. And I do think that this is a problem for scientists, that poetry, art, any kind of creative type mindset can really help. I think that we're trained to kind of ignore that side of our brain. And the more that we embrace our creative side, I think it makes us better scientists, because most solutions to scientific problems are going to involve creativity. And I've taught classes where creativity has definitely been beaten out of the students. And I would say that long term, I think embracing art, poetry, different ways to express things and kind of getting us out of our own way will be helpful for policy and for science. And it's something that we really need.
Yeah, we don't really need to speak to the scientists. They're the people that we're going to all the time and asking them for explanations. If it comes back as boring or didactic or, you know, just in any way, just something that's going to shut off the average person's head, that becomes a disservice. And where Sarah really excels is being able to explain hardcore science in a way that makes you walk away after a five-minute conversation with her thinking, well, I think I understand exactly what she meant about angle of repose and, you know, beach nourishment as opposed to some of the other natural processes that you might consider. So that's something that's people are always coming up to Sarah and asking for the kind of explanation that will draw them in. And drawing them in is really what is important about science, because we really need to know. We all have that need to know, because we're confronted with things every day that we need to address in one way or another.
In case you're just joining us, I'm talking with Len Germanara and Dr. Sarah Oktay. We're talking about science and poetry. More after a short break.